You are now tuning in to the Own the Build podcast. Join C-Link's very own Paul Hemming, where each week he interviews experts from the world of construction and asks all the important questions around intelligent construction management.
Hello and welcome to episode 150 of the Own the Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming. Thank you to absolutely everyone who is listening to the show. To get to episode 150, I wasn't sure at the start if we would get there, but here we are, and we couldn't do it without all of you guys listening. Wouldn't do it without all of you guys feeding back and telling me that you enjoy what we do. So thank you very much. It's amazing that we're here. We're returning today to our Future of Contracting series. And because it's episode 150, I kind of wanted to spotlight C-Link and what we do. So excuse the fact that we're going to be talking a lot about our product today and kind of the vision for our product, but here we are. For all these episodes, the Future of Contracting series, as you guys know, I will be joined in the studio by my good mate, Chris Barber, who is the CVO, the Chief Visionary Officer at C-Link. Welcome back to Own the Build, Chris.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for having me back on.
My pleasure, mate. My absolute pleasure. So as we've talked about before, the critical thing with the Future of Contracting series is that there will always be, or so far there's always been, a piece of content that's gone with it, usually written by myself because I get bored at the weekends, don't I? But if you go down to the show notes today, you will see there is a piece which is called The Current State of Play, How Main Contractors Manage Subbies Today and How They Will Manage Them Tomorrow. And let's talk about this article, Chris, because that's what we're here to do today. And I wrote this off the back of a conversation with a prominent tier one contractor who shall go unnamed. And what was really interesting to me, because I find these things very interesting, is that they decided to share with me kind of how they viewed the way that they were managing their commercial department today and how they then wanted to manage it tomorrow, talking about tech, blah, 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 blah. Now, it was as if they were sat in the pub with us in 2015 when we set up C-Link. So, question for you. Take me back to that conversation in the pub, and there'll be people listening thinking, blooming hell, we've heard the advert, lads, stop it. But why did we initially set up C-Link?
The reason, and you know, to give context, I was working for a main contractor, high-end residential, turnover around about £20 million, doing high levels of procurement, procuring vast amounts of packages ranging from the old leather wallpaper, Paul, that's been mentioned on the show before, to doing like, you know, your piling and your roofing, some of the standard packages. And every time I started a new project, I felt I was starting from ground zero again. And I would have to pick up the project, go through it, maybe have a look at what subcontractors have priced, have a look at the ones who are kind of like working with, and try and drum up a procurement schedule with the preferred subcontractors and the subcontractors who priced, and then start from there. And doing that time and time again for every single project is just mental. And it highlights how fragmented the industry really is. That,
well, not even just the industry, right? The company.
Yeah.
That, because I always had that as well. I would be on project with one PM, like as a QS, I might be working on two or three jobs, be on a project with one PM, I'd run it in a different way with the other PM, then I'd start another one with another PM, and it would be in a completely different way. So it's almost like indicative of how fragmented the industry is just within your own company and your own projects. Like the systems just aren't there, and you would have good QSs, bad QSs, good PMs, bad PMs, and it'd be a different experience on all of them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we weren't ever collaborating as a complete unit, as a complete company. We had there was nothing centralized who we were supposed to be using from a supply chain perspective. No sharing of performance on projects, you know, what subcontractors have done well, who's expensive, who delivers a really good product. We had none of this feedback coming into the system. So we were really kind of just doing it.
But it was your bright idea, wasn't it? What was it? I'm trying to think what it was that you can, how I was convinced by you that we should do this. What, like, what was it?
It was the time spent doing procurement and the importance of procurement. Procurement is the project. If you get it right, you'll deliver a high quality product on time and everyone will be happy to a certain degree. If you get it wrong, it's going to go drastically wrong. And the industry gets it wrong time and time again. And we never learn.
Yeah, yeah. And so if we, so I'll take you inside now, kind of the conversation that I had with this senior director at a tier one. And when this senior manager was talking me through the way this business procured, it did make you think, wow, even these guys are doing it like this. So they kind of broke it down into, as the ebook does, which is why I would suggest that everyone goes and reads that ebook. Like, this is how we are now, and this is how we want to be in the future. And so we'll walk through a number of their issues, and I just want you to talk to your own experience of these issues, see if it resonates, because it definitely did with me. So number one, and you've kind of just covered this, project teams procure in isolation with limited collaborative intelligence on subby history, subby performance, and we constantly miss out on opportunities to either, one, get discounts from procuring with subcontractors on two or three projects at the same time, or two, we actually overstretch the subby by, you know, we've got two different offices and they straddle both and they're on four projects when we only really want them to be on two, but we have no system in place which allows us to have that oversight of what our supply chain are working on, what they're tendering on, et cetera, et cetera. And they said to me, we know that we're losing money by doing this and we want a system in place to allow us to manage our entire supply chain. That isolation piece, you've already touched on it, but how does that make you feel hearing that?
I quite like the way that it's been picked up and recognised, I have to say that, because I think some people or some organisations would be a little bit ignorant to that being an issue, that the subcontractor's taken on too much and it's their fault. They shouldn't have accepted the job. It's their fault they're stretched. And someone who's approached you, Paul, and said, look, I want a system that gives me the foresight to, it was nice that they, obviously, the obvious one is let's negotiate a discount.
Yeah, yeah,
but actually,
yeah,
looking at it from a risk perspective is really refreshing. And I really like that. That is at the forefront. I don't want to be employing this subcontractor. He's already on a £500,000 job. If I give him another £500,000, I know he hasn't got the capacity. He'll take it because he likes working with us. We've got a good relationship, but it's going to be at the detriment to my project and the other project.
Yeah, you know, and so there are people who are not in our industry. Well, I think a lot of people listening will think, yeah, well, I work for a company and we have little systemized approach to understanding what our supply chain are working on. If you were talking to people in manufacturing, like car manufacturing, any other £1 billion company who were looking at their supply chain and didn't have oversight on where their supply chain were working, what the previous rates were, et cetera, it's centralized into a single point of reason. I think other industries would be wowed by the fact that we don't have anything for this. But that is kind of where we are as an industry. And that's what, you know, going, taking it back to C-Link, that's why we built C-Link, so that, you know, you can have that oversight, number one, on your supply chain and what they're doing. And then we're going to kind of get to where you would want to be in terms of lead times and so on beyond this. The second issue that was raised was with regards to lessons learned. And again, the feedback was there is no centralized hub where we are learning lessons. We are at best doing it, you know, I went to meetings before where you'd go to like a lessons learned meeting in inverted commas, and it would just literally be like, there'd be a Word document and people filling it out, and like, people wouldn't really care. There's no data associated to it, right? So they wanted a place where they could do that. And then another company that we now work with, we're actually talking about non-recoverables and scope of work gaps, right? So that a lessons learned would be, I don't know, on the roofing and brickwork, there was this variation, there was an interface scope issue there. And we've learned about it and we've closed it and we've got like a bank of scope of works and we will reduce that non-recoverable, right? And one of our clients said, oh yeah, I've got a, I call it my, I won't mention his name, the equivalent of, oh, it's Paul Hemming's bank of scope of works, right? Where after every single project, I update it and say, oh, I'm going to add this in so that my non-recoverables get less and less and less. And I said, and so what, do you share that with your team? And he was like, no, I've just got it for myself, which sounds so ridiculous when I say it, but that's what I've got. I just have it and I don't share it with anyone. I was like, imagine if you could share it with someone and it became a team thing. At the end of a project, you sat down and said, these were the scope of work gaps, let's close them. What's your experience, Chris, with non-recoverables and doing that?
I like the way you almost rolled your eyes at the lessons learned meeting.
Yeah, well, exactly. Because honestly, I don't think I went to too many lessons learned meetings. At my first company, we did them. At the second company I worked for, we talked about doing them and I never ever went to one. And at the second company, I probably worked on 10, 15 projects where I can assure you there was a lot of lessons to be learned from every single project. And we didn't do it. At the first one, you know, there was the intent to do it. But even that conversation, it might have fostered like a good conversation and maybe some change in the moment. But then it just kind of drifted off into insignificance. It's a bit like what you were saying about, you know, working with one site manager and then another project manager. You're not actually aggregating that lesson learned into anything meaningful. It's not kind of all talk, right? So that's why I was rolling my eyes, probably.
Yeah. I went to some of the lessons learned meeting, and I think it's got to be a culture led. It's a culture of the business, really. And it's not about finger pointing, which I don't think they necessarily are, but they need to have like some proper outcomes for like, what do we want to get out of this and how do we implement it to make sure there's a change that happens that impacts the wider business. Some people are like, yeah, just you need to come along to this lessons learned. You'll learn a lot. You might hear some people talk in a room, but unless it's summarized and succinctly put into a set of actions and, you know, the business acts on it, it's pointless, that lessons learned. That's why I was laughing about the eyes rolling.
Because you're rolling your eyes. And probably when I mention lessons learned, people listening, oh, boring. But it's also, you know, taking it back to previous guests on the show, Martin Paver, founder of Projecting Success, very focused on data, AI. He told me about the story of how his business was founded, and his business is kind of effectively machine learning, AI, data. He said, well, initially I went through reams of Microsoft Word and Excel lessons learned meetings, going through the minutes of the meetings, and I was trying to aggregate that data into something meaningful. And guess what? It drove me mad. And I realized that we should be doing something with AI, machine learning, blah, blah, blah. Now, the thing I agree with you, it's about culture, but it's also about like taking that commercial director who I spoke to, who's got his own lessons learned, but it's not shared with the team. It's, you know, and drawing it back. We're on episode 150 here, so we're going to crow about C-Link. Like, imagine a world where your scope gaps, your schedules of attendance, they're constantly adapting, they're constantly closing that non-recoverable. And if you're listening to this and thinking, yeah, that would be nice, it's, this conversation is framed from the fact that a tier one that we spoke to, £1 billion plus, told me they have no system for doing that in a sensible way. They're probably doing it in the way that Martin Paver was trying to aggregate. And that just shows you at times where we are as an industry, doesn't it? That a company with one of the biggest companies in the country is probably either not doing lessons learned or doing them in a way where lessons aren't actually learned.
And I think it's enabling and empowering the team to be able to give that lessons learned data that's almost in a bit of an impartial way, because it's going to be hard. See, people have got to open up from a culture perspective, and it's difficult. I mean, not many QSs are wrong. You know, if they've missed something off a scope and they've sent the drawings and there's a bit of a gray area, you know, the QS is right and the subcontractor's wrong in most cases in this situation. But regardless if it ends in a dispute or it gets cleared, the subcontractor basically backs down from it, we need to capture all that data. What were the scope gaps? What were the non-client variations, stuff that you couldn't recover? Let's understand that as a team.
Taking it back to our QS KPIs here, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. Back to the KPIs. And then that can give really informed lessons learned. And then sharing that with the team, and this is how we get better, not why did that job go wrong?
100% agree. And guys, if you're only just tuning in, I think going back to the QS KPIs episode 146, I think it was where we were talking about how you're measuring. I think it all ties together. I think that's probably why we're doing this series, Chris, every 4 weeks, that the fact is, through not a lack of will or want. I think that the culture's there. I kind of disagree with you a little bit, or go back to your point where you said, you know, the culture's got to be there. I think the culture is there for a lot of companies where they want to get better and they want to improve. That commercial director has got his own bank of scope of works where he is constantly improving it. But the problem is, he's doing it just for himself.
Yeah, but exactly. Yeah. That's what I mean, that the culture is there to improve, but in isolation.
Yeah.
Everyone's protective about their own IP or how they're getting on, because if they make a mistake, they might not want to share that with the team.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why it is culture-led. We've got to make it. Everyone will make mistakes, because that's what lessons learned are. People are making mistakes, but we won't make as many if we're all sharing the mistakes together and learning from them. And that's what I mean by a culture. I don't say people don't want to learn.
Yeah, yeah.
I know people want to learn.
Yeah.
I know people want to get better, because I was at QS doing the scopes on my own, because I was just a QS operating on my own, trying to do the best job I could. Whereas it should be coming top down from the commercial director. And this is how we're improving day in, day out for the business.
100%. And I've said this so many times on the show that everybody listening is probably bored of hearing me say it, but the perception of the construction industry is that people don't really care, or that it's an industry where, you know, it's a bit laissez-faire, like, is what it is. But the reality is, and speaking to so many people on this show, you are a big champion of it, I'm a big champion of it, but almost every single guest that I've ever spoken to wants to see cultural change, wants to see improvement in the industry. And the problem is, taking it back to this tier one, there aren't the systems in place to properly aggregate the data. And what we are building and what we champion at Sealing is, you know, and taking it back to that conversation in the pub, is all about how do you create an environment where you can constantly learn and constantly improve as a business with those systems in place. But I'm blathering on a bit too much about Sealing. I'll tell you what, guys, I'm going to let you listen to an advert all about Sealing right now, and we'll go to the break and we'll be back in a second. In construction today, a severe shortage of trades has become the norm. We talk about it a lot on the show, but for a main contracting business to thrive, you must create an environment that attracts subcontractors. At Sealing, we've worn the hats of subbies, main contractors, and we genuinely know what both sides needs. For main contractors, effective pre-qual is the linchpin of your success on any project. If you had real-time data on your supply chain's insurance, accreditations and financials, and even a wider pool of subcontractors to speak to, that would empower decision-making. For subcontractors, they want to receive comprehensive tenders with everything that they need to give you a good price. If you do that, you will massively increase your tender return rates. So, if you're a main contractor and you want to learn how to access real-time pre-qual data, grow your supply chain and deliver world-class tenders, you need to see Sealing. To find out more, you will be able to click a video in the show notes right now and also book a demo to speak to one of our team. We look forward to speaking to you soon. So, interesting first half of that show, Chris. And, you know, the way I'd kind of planned this episode in my mind was exactly how that tier one contractor framed it to me, which was, this is the current state of play. This is how we manage it today. And this is how we manage it tomorrow, how we want to manage it tomorrow. And in the first half, you know, we talked about the fact that project teams procure in isolation. There's little in terms of lessons learned, or if we do lessons learned, then we only do them in a way that is fragmented and not very helpful. Talked about siloing of documents. They actually also talked about the fact that they didn't ever really have oversight of lead times, like aggregated. They had poor audit trail, and generally speaking, their staff were dissatisfied by this, and it meant high churn in quantity surveying department. Now, I don't want to focus in on how they are working today. I want to now think about, in the second half of the show, what it would be like if they were working in a different way. And I want to start it because this is how they framed it to me. They said, imagine this world. So imagine a world where, for this is just for a QS, they had easy access to a company approved set of scope of works, a scope of works library that contained all of the lessons learned by our company, so that if that was the case, I believe all of my QSs would produce scopes of high quality with a reduced risk of variations. Now, that makes total sense to us, to everyone listening. But what I want to talk to you about it is, what would it have been like for you as a trainee QS coming in to the industry if your company had a company-wide scope of works library? Would that have helped, or would that have hindered your progress? Do you think it's actually been helpful to you individually that you needed to learn what the scope of works gaps were?
I say so because I kind of know the core packages inside out and what's required in them, because I used to pick up the drawings and specification, match the two up and just learn from that. There is, you've got to learn, but it, as a business, you've got to balance that as a business. So if I was a trainee QS coming in, I don't know anything. Someone says, go and pull a scope together. If someone said, here's the base scope that we've all worked on, it also comes with, like, you know, a foreword or some notes alongside it saying, you know, you should consider this, because not every project's the same. So, you know, if you had a basement project that included a groundworks package, it wouldn't be the same as just doing standard foundations.
Yeah.
You know, so there's going to be variance in kind of groundworks packages. But if they came with notes and instructions that will help inform why you're putting that into the scope of works for that particular package,
yeah,
I think it would be hugely, hugely beneficial. And it's not even stopping there. What that would do as a whole business, you know, if you're a trainee QS, you can kind of avoid some of the awkward conversations of like, what am I doing? I don't know. And feel like you're bothering your boss.
Yeah.
As a QS, you can kind of empower your trainee QSs then to try and do a lot of the legwork for you to get you off the ground. And then kind of as like a commercial director, looking at what a scope of works library would do is you are minimizing significant risk in your business and having the ability to upskill your staff really, really quickly into your business.
Do you think that having a scope of works library, which you're iterating on, you know, project in, project out, and what I mean is a lessons learned meeting would be, right, at the end of the project, or even at the end of each package, we're going to do a lessons learned on that package, and we're just going to look at the scope, and we're going to assess it, and we're going to say, that was right, that was wrong, we're going to fill this non-recoverable. So instead of it being 95% perfect, it's 95.5% perfect. And you're probably never going to get it to 100% right, because every project is unique, but you're closing that gap. Do you see it as a way for a QS to be sloppy and just be like, well, I've got the scope of works library, I don't need to worry about it? Or do you see it as a way of creating an environment where a QS is guided and more specific?
Guided and more specific. You have to balance it, and it depends how you sell it to your staff, right?
Yeah.
You say, yeah, don't worry about it, we've got scope of works, just dump it in. Because if you dump that in, it goes back to my frustrations that I talked to you about before, about doing the document dump every single piece of information on them. If you're putting things in the scope that don't match the drawings and specification, then you're going to look stupid and you're going to waste people's time, and it's inaccurate. So that scope will go into the order, and then you've got an inaccurate order. It's just going to be messy. So it should be, you know, there's obviously going to be core items that will be required for every package or certain packages, but it should be guidance that, you know, we've got this element of kind of, let's think about something that might be slightly different on a certain project, like a swale or something like that, and that's incorporated into the groundworks package. You know, that's not going to be on every job, but they should then be referred to, look, if you've got a swale, this is what we normally talk about it in the specification, in the scope, sorry, but go and check your reference specification. There might be this change. So it needs to come accompanied with some kind of instructions or notes to make it, basically move it from being sloppy and easy QS into being a really high performing, accurate quantity surveyor.
Yeah, because, you know, I've been told by some people, you know, well, that maybe that would make my QSs just think, whatever the scope of works is done, who cares? And I'm in agreement with you that no, it would mean that actually you can focus on the core problem of that package or the core challenge bespoke to that package, not just throw it away. Because what happens, and I have done this myself, I'm guessing you have, and everyone who I speak to who is a prospect of ours, when we talk about scope of works and the library that we have, says, so if I'm doing, you know, a single ply roofing package on a residential job, or I'm doing one on an industrial building, you know, or it's, there's different projects, but it's a scope which is new to me. What I will do is I will say in the office, guys, anyone got a scope of works for a roofing package on an industrial project? And then, no, sorry, mate. And then someone will say, yeah, I kind of have actually. And that will be, you'll take that and it will be a hack job. And you'll start from that as a baseline, which God knows how good that scope of works was in the first place. But that's kind of a process. That is a process that you recognise.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it might have a little reference in there to a certain item within that other project.
Exactly.
Like maybe even like a colour, a row colour or something. You might completely miss that. So you'd be prone to error on that copy and paste. Yeah. And that's why it's helpful sometimes in those small organisations, but it leads to lots of inaccuracies. And why is just one QS over here sent it? Shouldn't that be coming at least top level? Like your commercial director or whoever it is should be saying, this is the scope of works for this package and this is what we use as the baseline. You need to go and evolve it in line with the specification, but here's a good starting point.
100%. And honestly, we have people in our organization who are not construction people, who when they are with us speaking to clients, tier ones, tier twos, every construction organization does that process that we just talked about. And our non-construction employees say to me, what? I thought it would just be the smaller companies that did that. And you say, no, everyone does it. And I'm kind of a bit blasé about it now, but it is absolutely insane that as an industry, we're so used to being lackadaisical. That roofing, that fictional roofing package that I've just talked to you about might be worth 100 grand, be on the critical path of that project, be uber, uber important to the outcome of it. And I've just started from a point of, has anyone got one? And just, it's mental, but I'm sure me and you are not sat here alone. I'm sure there's people listening going, oh, I did that yesterday. Or I've got to do a dry lining one today. I might ask the same question. Why don't we as an industry have this set up? It's absolutely mad. And we talked about what it means to the trainee QS, what it means to the QS, what it means to the commercial director. And we talked about money there. We talked about how it will mean that instead of it being a 100 grand package that then goes to 110 grand because there was 10% of variations, it might be a 100 grand package that goes to 105 grand because you've closed 5 grand of scope gap. Brilliant. Every QS is delighted about that. Commercial departments happy about it. Business owners happy about it. But actually, it's time as well. And that's one of the big things that if you have a procurement system in place, big plug, C-Link, hello. if you have a system in place, it's going to save you a huge amount of time as well, because I'm going to take you back to that example that just came off the top of my head for that roofing package. How inefficient is that? That I go and say, has anyone got one? Probably takes me an hour to go around and you've got one. So you end up digging out. That's 2 hours lost for QSs. You send me one that is project specific to Bridge Street, a job from 2 years ago. Got to check it for building regs. I've got to check, has it got the spec in it? Has it got all different kinds of things that were specific to another project? So by the time I've untangled it, I've spent another few hours and it's still not useful. So
might not be any good either, Paul.
Well, if it was from you, it probably wouldn't be, would it? But
well, you don't know the quality of it. Has it been, you know, got the rubber stamp of approval from your execs, right? Yeah. Was that the project on the lessons learned 2 years ago where the roofing, industrial roofing failed, for example? That you don't know, do you?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It hasn't gone through an approval process that is what the business should be sending out. And
that would be just typical of you to send me one where the project failed. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we've ended up actually talking about exclusively the scope of works library on this episode, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but isn't really where I thought the conversation was going to be. But just thinking about the other utopian ideals that this tier one had, take it back to that conversation which I had. They also said, we want to imagine a world where the QS has an efficient procurement process focused on creating value rather than completing administrative tasks. Now, I'm going to talk you through a workflow that I was taught through by another tier one just a fortnight ago. They told me that their process for creating tenders at estimate stage was so ridiculously laborious that the estimator receives the tender, creates their own scope of works, uploads it to a portal, downloads loads of drawings. And this workflow had about 20 steps, all just for an estimator to go out to the tender on a dry lining package, let's say, at estimate stage. They walked me through all of that and then said that the QS will pick up the tender that was done by the estimator and repeat the entire workflow again. So they spend hours at estimator stage and they then spend hours at QS stage. This other tier one said to me, they said, we know for a fact that our procurement process is driving our QSs mad and leading to poor job satisfaction and leading them to potentially want to leave. And there's an ongoing attrition. I think that's a thing at you know, the larger companies, maybe less so at the smaller companies. What is your reflection of creating a tender pack for a project?
To repeat basically the same process, but it's quite normal to have gone through a repeat in the process because design and drawings change by the time you've gone from tender to construction phase. But I didn't really have oversight on what the quality of the tender pack that went out in the first place, because estimators are turning out, you know, basically a whole job in 4-6 weeks at main contractor level.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, they've got to do it quickly. There's going to be gaps to kind of cover. There's going to be gaps, basically. So they either allow for that within the pricing, or they allow for some kind of contingency, or it might be provisional sum, etc. So there's lots of things that can happen with a certain package. But I did have to pick everything back up, match all the drawings. I did start from ground zero on every package. There wasn't the audit trail necessarily, apart from a couple of like Dropbox links or folders, where this was what we went with at tender stage, and that was what was in the price. Kind of go away and make it work kind of thing. There wasn't that. With this roofing package, there was a lot of unknowns around this area. So we've allowed for X, Y, Z. Back to roofing, as we, you know, stay on theme. There could be a bit of an analysis around that package from the estimator, let's just say, but why it's priced the way it is priced. And this is what went out at tender stage. Mm-hmm. Being able to kind of pick that up seamlessly would make a huge difference.
Yeah. And again, systems aren't there to do that, are they? No. And it's funny that we talked in a few weeks ago, didn't we, about there's 5,000 to 10,000 vacancies for QSs. And that's all we really talk about, because we are both QSs. There's lots of other problems in terms of skill shortage, but there's not very many QSs. Your existing QSs are tired of the current process. It's monotonous and it needs to be a lot better and can be a lot better. Why would you have a QS shouting to the other side of the office about a scope of works? Why would a QS have to pick up what an estimator did and rerun that entire process time and time again? Why is there no consolidated data for lead times? Why is there no digital contract? Why is there no digital tender? These were all the things. I'm going to take you back to me and you sat in the pub 2015. I'm trying to remember what it was that was triggering you so much. What was it? It was probably a bad day. It was probably that leather wallpaper day, wasn't it?
It was the amount of rework that you were just mentioning, and just the time spent. It just felt so inefficient, and I have a huge disdain for inefficiency. It really bugs me.
Yeah.
And because being a QS, it's just littered with lots of manual administrative tasks, which the software out there for other industries at the time, it was kind of automating that flow, or at least helping assist with it, that the SMEs just don't have access to. And that was the big thing that was bugging me, that the fact that I had to get someone from our supply chain's contact details, I had to go into some Dropbox folder, into a spreadsheet that's got 1,000 tabs on it, to try and find someone for that specific type of metal roofing.
Yeah.
It's like, it should be jumping out to me on a system where I could just quickly go and find that. Same again with the scope of works. It really inefficient, bugging your fellow QSs. Can you tell me how to put, like, have you got a scope for that, mate? I don't know what I'm doing.
Do you know a subby? Do you know three subbies for the roofing package? Because I know one, but I need another two. Do you know any? No, I don't. Okay. Right, I'm going to go on Google. I'm going to have a look, and then I'm going to call 10 of them. I'm going to call all 10 of them. Three of them are going to say they're interested in pricing. Four of them aren't going to pick up. Another three are going to say, yeah, maybe send over the information. By the time I've then got it to the contractors who are, in inverted commas, interested, half of them haven't got the right insurance. Like, the entire process is absolutely, fundamentally flawed. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous for absolutely every company. I wholeheartedly believe this. There's almost every organization, tier one all the way down the tiers, they are doing things in a way that they could be dramatically different. And this conversation, we're going to take it back to this tier one conversation and these ongoing regular conversations that I have with clients who want to change the way that they're working. It's out there. People want to change. And if you had a system in place, a process where your QSs were given the freedom to be creative in their thinking, but also put on a certain train track for systems, documentation, scopes, all of these things, the world would be dramatically different, right? And everyone would be a lot happier. That's also the conclusion from this tier one, is that they have high attrition of QSs, and it could just be, it doesn't need to be like that. So I think where we get to today is that scope of works libraries should be a thing. They are on C-Link. Systemized approach to how QSs put documentation together is out there, and the way that we're currently doing it is inefficient. And generally speaking, change is coming now, and that's what we envisaged when we started in 2015, isn't it? And it feels like there's real momentum towards it now. Would you agree?
I agree. I think the main word that jumps out here is centralization. Mm. Like, centralizing those key commercial processes, it's absolutely clear what any QS has to do in that organization is central.
Digital toolkit.
The digital toolkit, right? That's what they need. They need it centralized. They can pick it up. It's plug and play. They start tomorrow. The commercial director's employing loads of QSs. You can upskill and onboard them in such a short period of time if you've got a centralized toolkit. And that is what the industry's missing.
Yeah, and my view on it is, and we'll wrap up now, but my view is that when it comes to construction technology, I'm going to get my little world's smallest violin out here for the QSs. But when it comes to construction technology, there has been kind of, over the decade or two of real innovation, the majority of it has been focused towards site. There's a lot of project management, site management, document control tools out there. Everyone will know all of those tools. You know, even up for snagging, right? There's loads of tools for doing all of this work on site. When it comes to the office, there is document control. That's obviously been a huge focus. And there has been quite a lot of focus on estimating pre-construction and getting that bit right. Where I genuinely think there is a gap, and that's the gap that we're trying to occupy, is for quantity surveyors, you know, and creating efficiencies in that commercial department, the department that drives, is at the heart of your profit making capabilities as an organization. There just isn't tools out there for them. We have talked today and many times before about how supply chain could be different, your scope of works, all these other elements could be different. Your digital commercial toolkit could make and transform your business. That's what we've built at C-Link. I would recommend that you guys go down to the show notes. There's a video in there. You can also have a demo meeting with me if you want to talk about it, or even with Chris, with the team. We'd be very happy to talk about it. And also, I recommend just reading through that ebook and white paper that I'm also attaching in the show notes, because that is the deep thinking of a tier one who thinks that they need to change. And I think anyone in construction, it will resonate with them. Chris, thank you for coming on the show again today, mate.
Thanks for having me back, mate. Speak soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And guys, as always, I will be back next week. That's episode 150. Here's to the next 150. Thanks very much. And I will speak to you next week. Take it easy.
Cheers, mate.